From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Middle Eastern actors are rarely cast on TV, and when they do get work, they often have to play terrorists. Then Nicole Holofcener's movies are usually about flawed human characters trying to figure out how to be an adult.
Definitely my wish is that people are moved and can relate to what I'm telling them. And selfishly, it's really just about me moving myself and feeling my own purpose in the world because, you know, it's hard to feel that way a lot of the time.
And the British singer Tirza has a lot of fun with some R&B grooves. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's Science Fair. Called inspirational and invigorating by the LA Times, the documentary follows 9 high school students on their journey to change the world through science. ScienceFairFilm.com. Science Fair, in theaters starting September 21st.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. It's a rarity for an actor of Middle Eastern or North African descent to get cast in primetime TV. And when they do get a part, it's often as a foreign bad guy. That's according to the first ever study to track this underrepresented group. Researcher Nancy Wang Yuen is the lead author of the report. It looked at the 2015-16 season in network cable and streaming TV. The study is aptly named Terrorists and Tyrants. Azita Gadazana is an American actress who was born in Afghanistan. She's the founder of the Middle Eastern and North African Arts Advocacy Coalition, which helped present the study. The organization successfully lobbied for including Middle Eastern and North African performers in casting databases. She told me when she realized that Middle Eastern actors like herself weren't being counted.
I was continuously testing for TV series, going through the auditioning process, and then getting down to the line, me and 2 other girls, me and, you know, 1 other girl. And a couple casting directors had kind of reached out to me privately that there were some, you know, issues like with my ethnicity. And I finally did get a job, a pilot in 2015. And I got to the table read early and the casting directors were there and they go, "Hey, Azita, are you ethnic?" And I was like, "Huh. My name has so many syllables." Yes. I never changed the name. I'd always kept true to where I was from. And I was like, "Yeah, I'm from Afghanistan." And they're like, "Yeah, but that's Caucasian." I was like, "Huh. Well, I never received the benefits of being Caucasian. I'm Middle Eastern, South Asian. I'm both." Afghanistan is part of the South Asian coalition, and it's also part of the MENA region. And they were like, "Oh, that's great. That's great. So we can check Asian." And I was like, "Yeah." And then they told me privately that we were counted as a Caucasian hire at many of the studios. So as the world kind of jumped into being more inclusive and diversity and representation became something that was really important and studios and networks became held accountable, the entire Middle Eastern North African region of the world was ignored.
One of the things that the report finds is that when MENA actors are cast, 2/3 of the parts are in crime or geopolitical dramas, and that nearly 80% of those roles are terrorists or soldiers or tyrants. And I want to talk about something that happened early last year. It was a week after the Trump administration announced the immigration restrictions on 7 predominantly Muslim countries. Fox aired the pilot episode of its new series 24 Legacy after the Super Bowl. It opens on a group of unidentified Afghan jihadis who have infiltrated the United States. They've killed an Army Ranger and his family in their home. Then they break into Sergeant Eric Carter's house. Let's listen to what happens.
"I want a strong box."
"What?
Where is it?"
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"A strong box that belongs to Sheikh bin Khalid, taken from his compound the night your squad came and killed him."
So I'm guessing that is not the exception. That's the rule?
100%. And there's so many problems right there. First of all, the Sheikh that he's saying is an Arabic name. And I don't know why the Afghans would be actually going in and fighting for the strong box taken from an Arabic man that has nothing to do with Afghan culture. And most of the time, Afghans aren't jihadis. They would be Taliban. So in that, it's just complete and total misrepresentation. And that is the norm when it comes to wanting to cast actors from that part of the world. Now, a lot of the times, they're not even, it doesn't matter if they're casting Middle Eastern, North African, South Asian performers in those roles. It doesn't necessarily have to be that. It could be anybody. It could be a Latino. It could be an American person that plays that role. But 80% of it, 78% of the time when we're seen, we are seen as visible threats. So if you're only seeing a saturation of us in the news, in these this kind of really negative light, and then you're only seeing us in mainstream television on hit shows as terrorists, where do you think we end up? And that creates so much shame for this community, because if they work and they want to take on the job, then, you know, oftentimes it's titled terrorist or bizarre buffoon or tyrant, and that's how they pay their bills. So it's like completely walk away and continue to let other people tell your story and degrade your nations, or, you know, stand up and fight for it. I've taken the route of, it angers me to be asked to do those things. You know, in 24 Legacy, I'd read for them plenty of times for one of the main roles, and they ultimately told me that I didn't look like people from my region of the world.
Now I want to talk about a good example cited in the study. It's Iranian-American actress Nikar Zadegan's portrayal of an attorney on Bravo's Girlfriend's Guide to Divorce. Her ethnicity is largely irrelevant to the part she plays. And in this scene, she's looking into sperm donors with a friend.
Oh, he's got soulful eyes.
Oh, God, he's a little swarthy, mixed with my DNA in between the kid's eyebrows and the stroller.
Okay, well, Edward 18. Blue-eyed, journalist, English.
Weak chin. Sign of a compromised immune system.
Oh.
Click on family history. See? What? Maternal grandfather died of congestive heart failure at 58. No, skip.
Okay.
So what happens in Girlfriend's Guide to Divorce that doesn't happen in most other shows?
Well, how wonderful is that, that Nekar got to play a lawyer without an accent? You know, she obviously has this rich history, and I think there were some parts in the show where, you know, they did allude to some of her, you know, really interesting kind of cultural makeup, because there's so many beautiful traditions in that space. But they didn't make her lean into anything that would be stereotypical. She's a woman who grew up in America and gets to play this lawyer. She's an accomplished woman. She has the same issues that every other, you know, American has, trying to get married, wanting to have a baby, starting a family, falling in love. So it's really lovely to be able to get to see those few exemplary characters. I know currently on The Legends of Tomorrow, Tala Ash is playing a superhero from the Middle East. And, you know, that's a wonderful example of something that's occurring right now, too. So we just need to kind of get more of those so that then people feel comfortable and have recognizable heroes, not just for the community, but just for the globe at large, so that they hear those names and they have a reference point of a hero or just a regular person.
Azita Ghanizada is an actress and activist. She's the founder of the Middle Eastern and North African Arts Advocacy Coalition. Azita, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, John, for having me.
Coming up, Nicole Holofcener's new movie, The Land of Steady Habits, has an unusual twist for her. It has a man in the lead role.
KPCC podcasts are supported by UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting political pundit and cultural raconteur Fran Lebowitz in conversation with Matt Holzman, Sunday, September 30th at 7 p.m. at the Theater at Ace Hotel. A sharp-tongued social critic and keen observer of the irony of human behavior, Lebowitz is often described as a modern-day Dorothy Parker and is known for her sarcasm, wit, and outrageous positions on current affairs and contemporary culture. Tickets at cap.ucla.edu.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Writer-director Nicole Holofcener came on the scene in 1996 with her first feature, Walking and Talking. It starred Catherine Keener and Anne Heche as best friends who were growing apart. Since then, she's consistently made funny, often poignant movies about women who feel real, like people you know or at least would want to know. But Holofcener's new movie, The Land of Steady Habits, is a departure. First off, it's about a man, and it's darker than her usual movies. The film stars Ben Mendelsohn, who's recently left his wife and has a strained relationship with his young adult son. It's also another departure for Holofcener in that it's based on a book, the novel of the same name by Ted Thompson. When Nicole Holofcener joined me recently in studio, we began with her reaction to Thompson's novel.
Couldn't put it down, related to so much of it, my age, my kids, my worries. And I really felt like I would never write this book. I would never write this story, the tragedies that happen in the book. And the bad behavior of this man, I just knew that it wouldn't come out of my imagination, and yet I was gripped by it. So I grabbed it.
What parts do you think wouldn't come out of your imagination?
Well, I don't want to give away too much of the movie, but the really, really sad parts. And I don't know if I would have chosen to write a male lead. It's not something I particularly felt like I had to do. But when I read the book, I thought, sure, this would be great. And didn't really think about gender. I just really liked the character and the story.
Okay, sorry.
You care so much about family pictures, you need to come and break in here in the middle of the night. What's wrong with you?
Well, I am a little dizzy.
Why don't you take a seat?
Don't tell me what to do. I'm gonna sit down anyway.
I've been divorced. I understand what that might look like for someone else. And, you know, having a kid that is such a source of worry, and his inability to know what he's doing as a parent, to be able to parent the best way. I mean, I feel that way all the time.
There's a scene in the film where Helene, played by Edie Falco, says to a girlfriend of hers,
"What did we do wrong? I don't know, maybe I babied him too much.
I must have done everything wrong.
When are we going to know if our kids are broken?
When are we going to know if our kids are broken?" And it's a really heartbreaking line, and it's not in the novel. It's something that you put in there. Why is that line important to you?
I told my kids that it was in the book. I was like, don't look
busted.
At me like that.
You're busted. Because I read the book. It's not in there.
That's funny. Good for you. I think it's every parent's worry, you know, and there's broken and then there's broken. Everybody's broken along the way as we grow up in little ways. Our hearts are broken. We don't launch when we're supposed to launch, or make money when we're supposed to make money, or get married or be successful. So I don't think she means literally like they would never survive.
Your kids, I think, are both college age. Is that right?
Yeah, they're 20, almost 21.
When you talk to them about stories, or when they look at a movie like this,
mm-hmm.
what do you guys talk about?
I ask them more questions than they ask me. I ask them how they feel about it, or what did they think of this. They will say things like, "Do you feel that way about us?" or "You're always so worried about us, Mom." They're very proud of me, but I don't lecture them or, you know, expect them to be that interested. And sometimes they are, and sometimes they're not.
Your films are clearly very personal to you, and I think they're also incredibly personal to audiences. And I told you this as we were walking in, that in 2001, I was at the Toronto International Film Festival, and I was watching Mira Nair's film, Monsoon Wedding. I came out of it to find out that 9/11 was happening, that buildings were collapsing and thousands of people were dying. And there's nothing I could do. I was stuck in Toronto. So I immediately went back into a theater to watch your film, Lovely and Amazing, and it took me to a place that was so different from the real world. It was incredibly therapeutic. I mean, it sounds very selfish of me to say that, but it took me into a world that felt different and good, even though it was a challenging story.
Paul and I broke up.
What is his problem?
Why do you assume it's his problem? Maybe it's my problem.
You don't have any problems.
You think I'm perfect?
I think you're lovely and amazing.
I'm narcissistic.
You are not.
Makes Paul sick.
This is what he does to you. Makes you feel bad about yourself.
Is that part of what draws you to cinema? That a movie can take somebody like me in the middle of the most horrible circumstances,
mm-hmm.
and that I become a person in a dark theater who is with your characters for 90 minutes or 2 hours and nothing else matters.
It was a very surreal experience for me as well to be screening the movie then. I wish that, you know, tragedy didn't have to happen for that. But, I mean, that's the magic of going to the movies, period. And if a movie's good and moves you, you're in. And I don't certainly plan that out. That's not my wish. But definitely my wish is that people are moved and can relate to what I'm telling them and will laugh when I'm supposed to be making them laugh. And selfishly, it's really just about me being creative and writing and telling the stories that I love telling, moving myself and feeling my own purpose in the world, because, you know, it's hard to feel that way a lot of the time.
We're talking with Nicole Holof Center. She's the director and writer of The Land of Steady Habits. I want to ask you about a sketch and an episode of Inside Amy Schumer that you directed. It was in 2015, and the setup is that Amy is out on a hike and she stumbles upon a very kind of formal party in the middle of the woods with Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Tina Fey, and Patricia Arquette. And Julia Louis-Dreyfus is celebrating her last day.
In every actress's life, the media decides when you finally reach the point where you're not believably f***able anymore.
I mean, how do you know? Who tells you?
Nobody really overtly tells you, but there are signs. You know how Sally Field was Tom Hanks's love interest in Punchline, and then like 20 minutes later she was his mom in Forrest Gump?
Or you might get offered a rom-com with Jack Nicholson where you're competing with another woman to f*** him. Or I just had an audition for Mrs. Claus.
You're kidding me.
I read for that part.
I read for that too.
I want to ask you about that. I mean, it's funny yet true that there is this.
That's what makes it funny.
Yeah.
You can laugh at it, but I hope that people are shamed by it as well. That fellas who make the movies and cast the movies will feel, oh, that's right. Although I imagine they're sitting in a room going, yeah, I wouldn't f*** her. Yeah, no, she's too old. I wouldn't. She's beautiful. She's sexy, but I wouldn't f*** her. I mean, those women are beautiful and sexy. You know, it's definitely a more serious topic. And casting my movies has sometimes been difficult because of that.
Meaning executives say, yeah. What about her? She's not...
Yeah, or they'd say, well, she's not particularly sexy. Or, what about, you know, somebody a little younger? You know, the lists are generally of younger women. And I want to work with people my age and people right for the part. But there have been times, yes, where they don't really say it. They'll just kind of be like, well, we like her, but what about blah, blah.
Does that work in reverse as well, that the actresses are talking about how the industry sees them as performers, and how does the industry see women as writers and directors?
Well, thankfully, a little bit better. I think, you know, there's sexism and racism in every business in all over the world. And, you know, we're no exception. And, you know, I do think about that for myself. Like, okay, Roman Polanski's, you know, 81 years old and he's making movies, and Woody Allen is, you know, same and he's making movies. How many, you know, old, old women are making movies? Agnes Varda, how old is she?
She's probably about 80. I mean, she's...
Yeah. Very few of us. So, I hope I can survive this sexist business.
You have grown up making movies. Your new movie is going to be released by Netflix. And then Tom Perata has adapted his own novel for an HBO series that you're going to direct. How is that shift helpful to you, that you have the ability to work for a streaming service or pay cable channel that maybe wasn't interested in the stories you wanted to tell 5 or 10 years ago, or didn't even exist?
Right. Well, I wouldn't have chosen a streaming network if I could get a studio to release my movie in a theater. I mean, it's shifted in so many ways. I mean, I don't know if I could have cast who I cast and made the story I made if I was relying on a studio. A real, you know, regular studio to do it. It would probably last 5 minutes in a theater. So this is good. And I had complete freedom. It's, you know, it's awful how it's all moving to our TVs.
Why is that awful?
Because the experience of being in a movie theater is like none other. Mm-hmm. It just isn't. And I don't have time to go to the movies. I watch movies on my TV. But when I do go to a movie, I sit there and think, why the hell don't I do this every day? I need it. It's therapeutic.
Nicole Holof Center, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
The Land of Steady Habits is available on Netflix on September 14th. Coming up, the British singer Tirza has a new collaboration with the acclaimed musician and composer Mika Levy.
At night, Carmen. Keep that.
KBCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's Science Fair, the number one audience award winner at Sundance and South by Southwest. Hailed by critics as inspirational and invigorating and supremely entertaining, the documentary follows 9 high school students from around the globe as they navigate rivalries, setbacks, and hormones on their journey to change the world through science. Visit sciencefairfilm.com for more information. Science Fair, in theaters starting September 21st.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Quick reminder, for the next couple of months, the repeat airing of The Frame will move from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. every Monday through Thursday night. We're making way for a new show called America on the Line. It's covering the run-up to the midterm elections in November. On Friday nights, The Frame's repeat airing remains at 7 p.m. And now, experimental musician Terza has a left-field take on 90s R&B slow jams. She's one of the many innovative musicians coming out of South London right now, along with King Krewal, Mount Kimby, and Mika Levy. She's the Academy Award-nominated composer who's known for her work on Under the Skin and Jackie. Terza and Levy are also good friends. They've been writing music since they were teenagers at Purcell School for Young Musicians in England, and they've collaborated on a number of EPs, including Terza's most recent full-length album, Devotion. It's a collection of sparse love songs released last month to great critical acclaim. Terza spoke with Frame producer Jonathan Shiflett. She talked about her new songs and the inspiration behind them.
I'm quite obsessed. I share this obsession of like dusk light on cars, on moving cars. Reflections. A lot of reflections, basically. So my name is Terza, based in South London.
I'll make you fine.
I guess repetition, I don't know, I enjoy doing it. It kind of reflects for me sometimes the actual beat itself, but also, you know, in repeating something doesn't necessarily give it the same meaning even though you're repeating it.
I'll make you fine. I'll make you fine, yeah. I'll make you fine.
It's kind of, I guess, experimental.
This feels so pure, this feels rare. I just want you to know that I'm here for you. You make me stronger, so I'm here to catch you. Don't worry about worries, I won't let them get you.
Practical music. I can't put my head around that, actually. My brain's just gone a bit like, It is what it is. If you want to dance to it, you dance to it. If you don't, you don't. Like, they're all just straight up love songs, drawing on kind of improvisation and as well as kind of, you know, more sort of house or electronic pop as well. I think it just always like a melting pot of ideas. So Mika Levy is a friend of mine who makes the beats, basically. When we're recording, we probably both, both of us are sitting down quite a lot, quite lazily. And then if I'm sort of starting to go a bit kind of mumbly or off-piece, she'll be like, why don't you stand up? I'm like, yeah, okay, let's give this some energy.
Do you know, I think about the time we were together. I thought that I would call you, but I never could do it. I don't get into begging to make you want me back. Yeah, it's my pride.
Usually starts with Mika's. She'll have a bunch of loops or beats, and sometimes we'll just like go for one and have a go at one, or sometimes we'll just lay them all next to each other and just play one after the other and just do a kind of long jam session. Kind of see what comes of that. End up with a lot of stuff that I feel bad for Mika having to then trawl through and edit. I don't know how she does it, because she's left with all the with all of it to then pick apart or leave as it is or whatever. Yeah. So Affection was a track that was recorded amongst a bunch of other songs that were built around loops that Mika had made, and we sort of put the names of colours to them all, just to sort of separate them all, and Affection was one. Oh god, I can't remember. It could have been green. I'm just gonna say that. Just could have been green.
Don't say you only want affection. Don't say you only want affection.
Yeah, it was kind of left as it was and as an improvised thing, and then Mika kind of built some lyrics in around it as well. Yeah, it's pretty meditative or something, I don't know.
We could hold on or we fall.
Having someone else write the music, I just know that that's how it works best for me, because I would just go round and round. It's just nicer, I don't know, leaving something out of your control, because those can sometimes be the most natural things. You can't kind of force it or, you know, labour on it too much if everything was under your kind of decision, your control. Yeah, and having worked together so long, I just just trust her. So yeah, she just layered it up, basically. I mean, I don't really call myself a singer. I think probably just think of it more as a musician rather than a singer. I don't come with any technical fireworks.
The new album by Tirza, Devotion, is available now on streaming services. And that's our show for today. Remember to follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow.
Time again. I want to see the way you look at me.